The day the beach left, Wind Island communities went underwater. Why over 140,000 did not evacuate? And how a hurricane made Galveston uninhabitable? This is NTWC Live.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to NTWC Live for Wednesday, September the 13th. Significance of that day is we're over the hump. We've passed the peak of the hurricane season, but it's still a busy time of year. We'll talk about what's going on today in the tropics a little bit. Good to have you with us today, along with Bill Reed and Hal Needham. Today, we've got Jeff Linder and Travis Herzog. We're going to talk about the 15th anniversary of Hurricane Ike and its impact on the southeast Texas coast, and look at some pictures and have a good conversation, I think. And we'll get a tropical update from Bill a little bit. Find out what's going on with GeoTrek with Hal, Dr. Hal, Hurricane Hal. So that's coming up in a few minutes. Before we get to that, though, we want to thank our sponsors who make these programs a reality each and every week. First of all, USAA. My goodness, can't say enough about USAA. From the beginning of programs we've been doing with the Storm Science Network, that Alex and I have been doing student conferences and all kinds of things for years, USAA has been a part of it, and we sincerely appreciate USAA and their support of Storm Science Network and NTWC Live and the National Tropical Weather Conference. So thanks to them for all they're doing. We appreciate that. The South Padre Island Convention and Visitors Bureau, the SPICVB, host for the National Tropical Weather Conference. We're back there first week of April of 2024 at the Marriott Courtyard Hotel. We hope you can join us on South Padre Island for that. Meet all the people that you see on these weekly meetings. Get a chance to visit with everybody and learn a lot more. We appreciate that. Also, the Weather Company, the company that provides a lot of the graphic systems you see on television weather broadcasts. We appreciate them. And Weather Boy, my goodness, what a great addition Weather Boy has been the last few years, sponsoring college students from all over the country to fly in and be part of the National Tropical Weather Conference. Thanks to Weather Boy and everybody there for being just a tremendous supporter and helping the educational aspect for college students for the National Tropical Weather Conference. We appreciate that. So a lot to get to today. We've only got an hour, and we're going to fill it, I have a feeling. And let's say good morning to Bill Reed, former director of the National Hurricane Center, and foregoing a tea time to be with us this morning. Good morning, Bill.
Yes. Good morning, Tim. Way my golf game has been absent during the heat wave this summer. I look forward to fall kicking in here. We have an interesting day. Hurricane Ike. I live down in League City, so we actually experienced some of the 80 to 90 knot wind gusts through the day. I say we. I was actually in Miami still at the time, my first year there. Our son lived in our house, and that's when I determined he didn't have the defective weather gene. Right as they were probably in the peak of the eye wall at our house, I called over, see how they were doing, and a female voice answered, and I go, okay. And then I asked to speak to Jonathan. He said, you want me to wake him up? I said, nah, don't bother. He slept through it. So, yeah, and Icus, until we had Harvey, was probably our most memorable event for the people currently living in the area now. I'm going to introduce one of our guests and then turn it over to Hal to introduce the other. I'm going to introduce Jeff Linder. He is his title is Director of Hydrologic Operations and Harris County Meteorologist. Obviously, in that role, he's the one who oversees their operations of what the Harris County Flood Control District does to deal with flooding and other weather events in our area. Known Jeff since you graduated from A&M and came down to the job there. And you've been a very valuable partner in the National Weather Service's role of issuing warnings for the area and educating us and your public as to what the threat is. So welcome to the show.
And thanks for having me, Bill. Thanks.
You bet. We'll talk here in a minute. Hal, if you would introduce Travis, we'll be on our way.
Yeah, good morning, everybody. We're so excited to have Travis Herzog on the show this morning. Travis is the chief meteorologist at KTRK-TV in Houston. He's covered every kind of severe weather and extreme weather event in Southeast Texas. He's a safety advocate, empowering his viewers to make wise choices during severe weather. Travis, welcome to NTWC Live.
Hurricane Hal, it's an honor to be here, and I'm excited to team up with Jeff. We actually graduated the same class here at A&M, so we've got a lot of stories to share over the years.
Cool. We just won't talk about football today. I'm going to pop up the track just to refresh everyone's memory and then turn it back to you to talk about the sequence of events that occurred as it made landfall. I came all the way across from the Cape Verdes as a powerful hurricane most of its path. This is the point in the Gulf at which the National Hurricane Center issued the hurricane watch, which at the time was the farthest, it was 60 hours in advance of our forecast landfall, which was one of the longest lead times we put out. Because of forecast errors, forecasters were somewhat loath to go with a watch and warning any too much farther out in time because the area gets so large. If it was today, the error cone would be down to about half of what it is there, and there'd be much less area under the watch mode there. But obviously, this is at the point where there's a severe threat to impacts in Southeast Texas, and it didn't really change much as we went through the storm there. So I'll stop my share and let Travis take it from there as to how it approached and what happened when it made landfall.
Thank you, Bill. Let me share my screen here and get my presentation going. So rewinding just a little bit here from the point at which Bill just showed you the forecast when it was actually over the Gulf of Mexico. This is when it was off the coast of Cuba. It came into Cuba as a major hurricane from the east and never really quite regained its power after that. But this was a Cape Verde storm, and those are the big ones. Those are the bruisers that come all the way from the coast of Africa. I did a study many years ago just because I was curious, how much time on average do we have from when a storm forms to when it makes landfall in Texas? And it's usually on average about 3 days. So this was one of those rare exceptions where we had almost 2 weeks to watch this thing, not knowing it was coming to Texas at the time when it first formed off the African continent. But it was one that we were watching for a very long time. And we're all human beings, and these types of events don't happen in some scientific vacuum. We have personal things going on in our lives. And this was a really challenging time for me personally, because a month prior, our first son was born. And then 2 weeks after that, my mother-in-law passed away. And so here we are celebrating this new life and grieving the loss of another. And then in the middle of, after my mother-in-law's memorial service, Tim Heller, my chief at the time, said, by the way, keep an eye on Ike, because I think it's coming our way next week. And so get back from that, and here we go, hit the ground running. Ike ends up knocking out our power for 2 weeks and flooding our house. So when it rains, it really does pour. But the reason I like to show this graphic right here is I remember very distinctly that this was the forecast. And if you notice, the center line of the cone, very similar to what Bill showed you when it was over the central Gulf of Mexico. This was clued in very early on as this was going to be a Texas storm. But something happened between this 4 p.m. advisory that came out central time and the 10 p.m. advisory. In the 10 p.m. advisory, the center of that cone shifted south more towards Corpus Christi. And I distinctly remember we were watching a different newscast that came on an hour earlier than ours. I was with my wife at home, and the person on TV said, hey, the forecast just came out. Looks like it's going south, so I think we're going to be okay. And I was just like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, this thing is still days away. And I told her, pack your bags, because you've got a newborn and you're grieving the loss of your mom. You're going to College Station. So that was the moment that I made the call that she's going to get out, because I knew that soon I'd be hunkering down more than likely. So I'm going to show you next a satellite image. This is a loop kind of showing not the full life cycle of Ike, but from what was about a category 4 over the open Atlantic to when it made landfall in Cuba. And because of how much time it had to mature as a hurricane, this became a very large storm. You're seeing that right now in real time with Lee when it comes to the distance of the radius of the maximum extent of hurricane force winds. As I got into the Gulf of Mexico, it just continued to grow larger, and the wind field was massive. And so when you look at the direction it was coming from, how large it was already a full-fledged hurricane when it emerged. It had a lot of time to push a lot of water towards the curved coast of Texas. And that had huge implications for what it ended up doing when it came ashore. Even though its wind speeds were just at category 2 level, it produced a surge that when you look at the original Saffir-Simpson hurricane wind and damage scale, that scale also was tied somewhat to surge level. And from a surge perspective, it would have been classified as a category 4 or category 5 type surge based on the original scale that came out. So that was a look at it coming in on satellite. when it got into our radar network, you can see just how large the eye is. The eye was on the order of about 50 miles wide. The pressure at this time, even though its winds were 100, 110, was about 949 millibars. So it had a very low pressure, very large wind field. And you may have heard before about a different type of way of measuring hurricanes based on their total kinetic energy, the Integrated Kinetic Energy Scale, also called IKE, ironically, showed that this one had tremendous power. And so even though the winds may not have been as strong as some of these rapidly intensifying Gulf storms we've seen in recent years, it was a tremendously powerful storm because of the large extent of the hurricane force wind field. At the time of landfall, I believe the last advisory that came out prior to landfall showed that the hurricane force winds extended eastward up to 175 miles. So when you look at Hurricane Alicia, which was the last technical major hurricane to make landfall in Southeast Texas with 115 mile per hour winds, you could fit several Alicias inside of Ike's hurricane force wind field, not to mention the tropical storm force wind field. So size definitely matters when it comes to these hurricanes. And I remember our friends, I know, Bill, that you were in Miami, but your friends that you left in the Houston Galveston forecast office commented on just how ferocious the western and southern part of that eye wall was as it went right over the forecast office there in the border of Dickinson and League City. So most of Houston was raked by hurricane force wind gusts, and that alone was enough to take out 99% of CenterPoint's customers went offline. Some came back pretty quickly because they were, hospital related and emergency service related. So they got them on pretty quickly. But most people in Houston were without power for at least a week. And in many cases, if you had something like Oaks in the name of your neighborhood or some tree, a lot of old mature trees in your neighborhood, you were without power for at least 2 weeks. And so it took a long time to get the city back up and running again. That was inland. But the real devastation occurred along the upper Texas coastline. And the tragedy here that I recall is I remember waking up Friday morning. So this made landfall early on Saturday morning. I wake up on Friday. I know I need to be in by noon. We were told be to the station by noon, and then you're locked down until this thing is over and we say you can go home. So I turn on the TV. It's around 6, 7 a.m. to ABC 13. And already the water is at the top of the Galveston seawall. Remember, that was built in the wake of the 1900 storm. It was supposed to be about, at the time, offer protection of about 17 feet above sea level. And so we already have waves that are topping the Galveston seawall. And a lot of folks went to bed on Thursday night. They were already under an evacuation, mandatory evac along the Bolivar Peninsula. They said, you know what? It's just a two. I'm going to wait and see what it's like in the morning, and then I'll get out. Well, when they woke up on Friday morning, the roads were already covered in water. Because of how large the wind field was, because of the angle of approach, and the fact that it was already a hurricane when it came into the Gulf, it shoved so much water out ahead of the actual rain band. So this is 18 hours before landfall. There's not a single drop of rain over land yet, and you've got this massive surge that is already coming in. So a few days before the storm made landfall, the USGS sent some aerial photographers along the coast to do some reconnaissance. They took pictures up and down. You can still access these images today. This is a stretch of the Bolivar Peninsula called Crystal Beach. And so you've got some yellow arrow markers on the left and the right to kind of give you kind of some perspective, because on the next image, you're not going to recognize anything in between, because this is what it looked like after Ike came through. That's what a 15-foot storm surge will do to a relatively unprotected stretch of coastline. They had some geotubes, some sand dunes, but there wasn't the kind of protection that you see, say, on the east end of Galveston, where that part of the island was lifted up after the 1900 storm and had a seawall to offer up some protection. So the eye of the storm went in right around the east end of Galveston Island towards Pelican Island. And so all of the surge, the maximum surge, was forced right into the Bolivar Peninsula just to the east of Galveston. And this was the kind of devastation that you saw. Farther east from here, there was a town called Gilchrist. I say was because at the time it was literally wiped off the map. This small coastal fishing community, this is what was left. So this is flying eastbound along Highway 87. That bridge you see in the middle, that's Rollover Pass, which was mostly destroyed. And you can even see the geotubes on the right side of the screen near the bottom. You see those long black lines. Those were the tubes that were acted as some protection from, the typical nuisance type floods that can happen when we get a long easterly fetch. And you'll notice there's literally one house on the Gulf facing side of the Bolivar Peninsula, that remains standing. There's a few more on the backside over towards East Bay on the left side of your screen. You'll see a few houses back there, and then a few more farther down the road that were, again, on the north side of Highway 87, but just tremendous coastal erosion. There's a zoomed-down view of the house that survived. I'd like to know who built that, because they built it to amazing code and standards. But just look at the ruts in the ground caused by this storm. So this was a tremendous, tremendous storm surge that came on through. And again, the peak estimate was about 15 feet. Jeff can get more in the weeds on the exact numbers. And I think, you know, there were much higher waves as well. And here's a satellite view of before. This is the Bolivar Peninsula. And that really thin stretch that you see near the upper right corner, that's where Gilchrist is located. And then this is the after satellite to show just the massive coastal erosion that occurred. You saw the beaches just get wiped out here. Even in front of the seawall in Galveston, you had major beach erosion. There's just a lot of any structure that was south of the seawall got destroyed by the surge, even though the peak surge missed Galveston Island. So just a tremendous surge event here. And that's really what tore up the playbook, as Bill was talking about, with between the difference between, you know, tying things to a category, a number. That's when we divorced any semblance of surge from it in the wake of this. And it was time to rethink how we do this, how we message the hazards of a hurricane. Because again, a lot of people said this was just a category 2. I'm going to wait this one out and just see if it gets any worse. And a lot of folks lost their lives because of that fateful decision they made not to evacuate before the surge started coming in. So that was kind of a brief synopsis of the storm coming in and just kind of one of the biggest impacts that we had. So for those of us inland, you know, obviously surge is not a thing, but for those that were along the coast, it was a life or death situation on whether or not they went out or whether they stayed. And I remember that we had at the time a reporter named Wayne Dolcifino. Anyone that's from the Houston area will remember him. He was our longtime investigative reporter. I don't know what it is about these investigative guys, but they also like to chase hurricanes. Ted Oberg did it for us. Our new investigative guy, Kevin Ozebeck, he came from Miami. He's like, I like to chase hurricanes. So it just goes hand in hand, I guess, with the personality of an investigative journalist. But he said when he came back, because he stayed on Galveston Island, and so the day after he comes on set, he gives an interview. And when we go away to a break, to a different story, he says, well, I'm glad they didn't take my idea to put the truck on Bolivar, because that's where I wanted to ride this one out, you know. So he ended up, I think, at the convention center in Galveston to ride the storm out, because it would have been a totally different story if he brought that vehicle onto the Bolivar Peninsula. That may have been the last we saw of Wayne Dolcifino. So you have to respect the water. And those surge warnings that we have now are just crucial to helping save lives. And I really credit, Bill, a lot of the stuff that you set in motion to get us to where we are today, to why we've seen such low surge deaths up until Ian, but the previous storms that we had in this kind of cycle we've been in since 2017, we've seen a low loss of life because of surge until what happened with Ian just last season. So I'm happy to share more stories later on about kind of what was going on behind the scenes here, because it was all kinds of crazy as we were dealing with the impacts of the hurricane. But that's a brief synopsis of what it did coming ashore and some of those impacts.
It was excellent. I people always ask me, what do you think your best accomplishment was at NHC? And it's a real simple answer, selecting Jamie Rome to run the storm surge program.
He's done a great job.
Took all the old stuff and basically put it in the dumpster and started doing it in a modern way, and it's paid off. Turn to Jeff now. What was Ike like at the Harris County EOC and flood control world?
You know, I don't think you can talk about Ike and the evacuation of Ike and trying to move people without talking about Rita. So Rita was 3 years before Ike and 6 weeks after Katrina. And for those of you that were in Southeast Texas for Rita, you'll remember very vividly the evacuation attempt with Hurricane Rita. And of course, Rita was the first evacuation attempt this area had tried since 1988 with Hurricane Gilbert. And so there had been a tremendous amount of population growth between the late 1980s and the mid 2000s. People moving here, not really understanding evacuation zones, how evacuations are done. And there were quite a few mistakes with Rita, both on how the evacuation was called, what was called. And it was really just everybody run At some point. And obviously we can't have that here with our freeway systems. There's just no way we can move 5 million people on our freeway systems. And so we learned that hard lesson. And so we had much better tools in place with the zip code evacuation maps and all that for Hurricane Ike. But as has been talked about already, Ike was not Rita in the Gulf of Mexico. So you look at Rita, 170, 180 mile an hour hurricane, category 5, barreling toward the Texas coast. Those decisions become a lot easier for people when you see that already out there. The challenge we had with Ike was when the evacuation, I think we made the decision on Wednesday to pull the trigger on the evacuation. Most of the evacuation occurred on Thursday. It was very sluggish. It was very slow. There were certain areas down on the Gulf coastal part that were very, very slow in pulling the trigger. We were way past our timelines in starting to move people. And a lot of that was we evacuated Frida. Nothing really happened. We want to make sure something's going to happen. Oh, and by the way, my plan tells me that I don't really do a whole lot for a category 2. And again, we stressed and stressed and stressed. You can't look at the category. You have to look at the impacts, the numbers. We're talking 10 to 15 to 20 feet of storm surge. Forget the category. And that became very apparent with Ike that, you know, people were making decisions based on the category. And so the evacuation was very sluggish. And traffic was not necessarily a big issue because of that. A lot of people did not leave, and people had time to leave. One thing we did not do well was explain and convey the timing of the onset of the storm surge. And so I think for most of us, we focused on the peak. We kept talking, this is big, this is high, the high values, but we did not convey that by Friday morning, late Thursday night, Friday morning, a whole 12, 18 hours before the tropical storm force winds get to the coast, our evacuation routes are going to be cut off. And that left challenges on the west end of Galveston Island, Kima Seabrook, and obviously on the Bolivar Peninsula. And so, you know, a lot of people made that decision on Thursday, let me wait, just like they did with Rita, let me wait, let me be 100% sure we're going to get hit, and then I'll get up Friday morning and I'll drive off. And by Friday morning, we had 4 or 5 feet of water covering Bolivar. And there was no way for those folks to evacuate. And there was never in any of the lead up to Ike, any of the products, any of us really talking about that early onset of storm surge. And I think that's one thing that kind of got us, because we were so focused on the height and the maximums to get people out, because really if we would have been thinking about it, we would have had to move everything up a good 24 hours to have evacuations completed by Thursday evening. And so, you know, that's one thing that we obviously have to pay very close attention to here in the Gulf with a big size storm that can move water to the coast early, because we have to get everybody out. And I think there was about 900 people on Bolivar that were airlifted out on Friday, and they were taken to Ellington Field because there was no way to get off of Bolivar on that Friday. And so, you know, that was a big lesson learned, is to make sure we're paying attention to when the water is going to start coming. You know, if you read any of the accounts from the 1900 storm, very similar accounts. The sun was shining in Galveston, the wind was out of the north, and the water was coming up on the island. And if you go back to Ike, it's almost exactly the same. It was not raining, the sun was still out, and the water was coming up on the coast. And it was really interesting that tended to force additional people to leave on that Friday morning who could. So like Travis said, he saw on Friday morning the waves crashing into the seawall. People saw that, and if they could still leave and they could still get out, they got out. And so we actually saw a secondary bump in the traffic on that Friday around midday of people seeing the images on the coast and starting to move. And so, you know, those were kind of the two lessons, if you will. There was a mention about power, and I think we were a little bit spoiled with Ike. You know, what I've always kind of said is the worst thing we had to do inland was turn the power back on. As soon as the power came back up, most of everybody's lives went back to normal. There was not significant structural and infrastructure damage inland from the wind. And so, you know, like I think Travis mentioned, we had a really good tropical storm. We had a really strong tropical storm with some hurricane wind gusts across most of the metro area. There's some trees down, but you didn't see roofs off. You didn't see, you know, your Home Depots and your HEBs, you know, caved in. And as soon as that power came back, people could go back to work and back to buying things and stuff like that. And so, you know, that's not always going to be the case. The time to restoration for power for a major hurricane impact here is 4 to 6 weeks. And so, you know, we got power. Most people had power back on in 2 weeks. It was really, really good. Although we could go back to it as like that, those were horrible 2 week period without the electricity here. And so just a reminder that when you're looking at these bigger storms, you know, Laura, your Ian's, your Laura, stuff like that. And you go and you see those great big metal transmission towers laying on the ground. You ain't putting those back up in a couple of weeks. And so it's going to take some time to get the infrastructure back in place and then get our lives back in place, if you will, so we can actually function again. And so we didn't really have a lot of that with Ike. But as mentioned before, this was definitely the storm surge and the water on the coast that was the challenge with the storm.
That's very good. The long lead time issue, we should have known, I guess, the big storm moving from east to west in the Gulf, the ones that have done that in the past have flooded a tremendous amount of flooding starting way in advance of that. We did know in a way, because that was the call on Rita too, a big storm heading towards us. The Galveston County officials jumped the gun for the evacuation a good 60 hours before the forecast landfall. The challenge is you have to really, if it's going to hit like Ike, you have to get the people moving about that far out in time. And that's running counter to the human nature that says, I want a little more certainty before I go. You know, blue skies and light winds and a still uncertain forecast is very tough. And I guess we're going to continue to grow, and the challenge of evacuation is going to stay there. Any ideas on that?
You know, it's interesting. We do this stuff all the time. We go through drills. We do what we call integrated warning team workshops, where we put all of us in the same room and we throw a hurricane at us and we watch the decision-making that happens and the timing of that decision-making. And evacuation is a very complicated decision. I think people simplify it a lot of times to a point where, well, you just say yes or no, right? And you just go. It's very complicated. The logistical stuff that goes into it to move a lot of people is a challenge sometimes, both in many realms. You have medical situations with a lot of people. You have hospitals, you have nursing homes. And then you also have the fuel side of it and the transportation side of it. And so there's a lot of things happening in an evacuation effort all at the same time. And in our area, elected officials, county judges, city mayors are the ones who have the authority to call for the evacuation, usually at the advice of their emergency manager. And so most will, whatever my emergency manager says, I'm going to, you know, implement that. You know, the challenge we face is everybody that is in those decision-making roles is no different from the rest of us. And so when you look at this, the first thing that comes to mind is this really going to happen? And am I going to pull the trigger to call for this evacuation? There's obviously a cost associated with all this. And then the thing is it going to miss us? Because, well, they always seem to miss us. You know, I mean, how many times have we, if you look at Gilbert 1988, you look at Rita, you know, we didn't really try an evacuation for Hurricane Alicia. You're way back to Carla in 61. We don't do this very often, and we haven't done it since Ike. And so, you know, when you get into that decision-making process, it seems so easy. And you go through these drills, and we all sit there and we listen, and, oh, yeah, we're going to leave. We're going to pull the trigger. We're going to leave. And then you get to something like Ian. And again, you see the sluggishness, the slowness of pulling those triggers when really they should be pulled. And so it's not necessarily a bash of any of the decision makers when it comes to these decisions. There's just a lot that goes into it. And the struggle we really face, the thing that really concerns me is not an Ike or a Rita where we have the time. It's if we don't have the time. You know, it's your Laura or your Ian or your other quickly developing Gulf systems, because it takes so much time in a big evacuation to move the resources into place to pull it off. You know, you're pulling TxDOT and DPS employees from the entire state, from Amarillo, from El Paso, from the Valley up here to deal with the freeway system to successfully get people out of here. And so that all takes time. And if you look at our time to order the 1,200 buses that we require just in Harris County alone, we're looking at placing that order to the state of Texas around 90 hours out. So if you're talking about something that doesn't even get going until 60 hours out, we're 30 hours behind the curve on getting the needed resources in here to be able to get everybody out. And this is the same problem they face in New Orleans, in Miami, in Tampa, any of these big metro areas along the coast. And we saw that, what was it, I believe, with Laura, or no, not with Laura, with Ida a few years ago, with New Orleans making the decision not to call for that mandatory evacuation of the city of New Orleans, A, because they felt the levees would hold the water back, and B, because they just simply didn't have the time to successfully pull it off. And so those are the really big challenges, is when we get those rapidly developing storms kind of close to the coast. Luckily, for the most part, those aren't huge like Ike. They tend to be smaller and maybe not generate as great of a storm surge. But I think evacuation and the whole topic and all that is something that will be debated and discussed well beyond my time.
Let me jump in, guys, real quick. We're already halfway through the show. We're flying. This is great stuff. And I hate to interrupt the conversation, but let's do that for just a moment and thank our sponsors, USAA, the Weather Company, the South Padre Island Convention and Visitors Bureau, and Weather Boy, folks who make this a possibility. We'll continue to the discussion here in just a moment, but let's go to Bill for a quick update on what's happening in the tropics today. And then we'll go to Hal, and then we'll get back to Travis and Jeff with more info and some great discussion about Ike, kind of a legendary hurricane, if there's such a thing. Bill.
Y'all, we're going to continue with the broadcast here. We're going to talk a little bit about the GeoTrek update next. GeoTrek travels the world looking for stories related to extreme weather and natural disasters not covered by the mainstream media. I was on the ground 2 weeks ago for Hurricane Idalia in Florida. And, you know, actually, we just launched our podcast from Hurricane Idalia yesterday. It's podcast number 78 called Voices from Hurricane Idalia. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts, Apple, Spotify podcast. It's episode number 78, Voices from Hurricane Idalia. And you know what's interesting? Some of the lessons we learned in Idalia actually relate to some of these stories from Ike, as far as people getting surprised by surges where they didn't expect them. And in one place I visited, and you can hear the audio on the podcast, I experienced the landfall of Idalia near Apalachee Bay, very close to the point of landfall. But the day afterwards, I went down to Tarpon Springs. It's a small community on the edge of Tampa St. Pete metro area. And I was interviewing folks there, and they were shocked. Y'all, there was not a tree branch down. I mean, there was no wind damage at all. People thought that they were going to weather the storm just fine. And here comes a storm surge without really strong winds. Here comes a storm surge of about 5 feet high. Might not sound like a lot, but a lot of Tarpon Springs has an elevation of around 3.5 feet in the old business district. Tarpon Springs considers itself the sponge capital of the world, has a lot of Greek heritage from Greek sponge divers that moved to the area in 1905. So tons of Greek restaurants and Greek speakers. We interviewed some of them, and they were just really surprised to see a big storm surge show up when they didn't really have much wind. And I was thinking, wow, if this is really the highest storm surge, it was the highest storm surge at a lot of the people we talked to had ever seen, even if they had been there 25, 30 years. And this was from a small, geographically small, fast-moving hurricane that made landfall all the way up in Apalachee Bay. It makes you wonder if you had a larger, slower-moving system closer to Tampa St. Pete, maybe making landfall in a place like Clearwater or Tarpon Springs or even Cedar Key. That would produce a massive storm surge with a lot of impacts there in places like St. Petersburg and Tarpon Springs. So again, people were surprised, and there were a lot of these similar lessons with Ike as far as storm surge moving in really without much wind in the case of Idalia. In the case of Ike, what we're hearing this morning is the winds eventually showed up, but the surge pushed in before the winds arrived. And so that's something that was common. And again, just a lot of people being surprised and taken off guard. So that's the update from GeoTrek. We'll be with you next week for another update. Thanks for letting me give an update here, and let's get back to the show.
All right, guys, great stuff. Let me ask the one question we have from online right now, then we'll go on from there, and Bill and Hal jump back in. But the question is, what kind of changes have been made to the infrastructure in the oil industry and the refineries after what happened during Ike? And I don't know who wants to jump in on that, Jeff or Travis, but you know, the gas prices spiked a little bit after that. Have there been changes made?
No, not really. There hasn't been any significant infrastructure changes anyways. You know, most of the ship channel does have protection up to around 10 to 12 feet. So either flood walls or levee type systems that protect the petrochemical industry up to about that level. And Ike Surge was right at that level. Texas City, Freeport are protected by levee systems here, federal protection. And, you know, the northeast wind across Galveston Bay with Ike actually did push and kind of pile the water up on that northeast side of the Texas City levee. And there was some wave action that kind of splashed over and eroded a little bit of the top of the levee on that northeast quadrant of it. And so, you know, folks in those areas, I don't even know if they realize they're protected by levee. But, you know, just like in New Orleans, like what we saw with Katrina, one day these flood walls and levees and all that will be overtopped. And, you know, the unfortunate thing is as far as infrastructure goes, if you look at Bolivar, we practically swept Bolivar clean and then have gone back out there and put multi-million dollar homes on it. Yes, they're built stronger, they're built higher and all that. But I saw in Southwest Florida with the Hurricane Ian survey, storm surge survey, in areas Bonita Springs and areas like that where homes were built very well to code, there was still significant storm surge damage, especially to the ground floors. You know, a lot of the living areas up, but people still put a lot of expensive stuff down on those ground floors. You know, and technically you have the breakaway walls, which we also learned after Ike, weren't all constructed properly. They actually tied the breakaway walls in some cases to the structure. So when the walls did what they were supposed to do, they started to break away. It ripped the back of the structure, a portion of the elevated portion of the structure off. And, you know, that's defeats the purpose of it. And I think one of the challenges, I probably did not expose this very well, but one of the big challenges we're going to face here is when we do have a big windstorm, our laxed building codes here when it comes to wind. We haven't seen that in a long time here in the Texas coast. And that's what we saw with the storm surge aspect. We're going to see with the wind aspect and those not requiring certain standards here, especially a little bit further inland, is going to get us one day. But as far as infrastructure goes, you know, there's all this talk about the coastal system, the coastal barrier, kind of nicknamed the Ike Dike. You know, Congress has that, but it is not funded. And so you have to give funding to it to get it built. And, you know, there's still issues with the environmental impact of it, what the residents along the coast feel about it, especially over on Bolivar. And then the gate structure that would go across the opening between Bolivar and Galveston Island, kind of where the ferry goes now, and any sort of pumping system that would go on the backside of this. So, yeah, you can stop the Gulf of Mexico seawater from coming in, but then how do you get rid of the excess stormwater coming into Galveston Bay from rainfall and all that? You know, I think that's probably being made a bigger deal out of than it needs to be, because the surge kind of offsets a little bit from the rainfall. You're not immediately going to get a large amount of runoff into Galveston Bay from rainfall. At the same time, you're getting the big high storm surge. So I think, you know, all of these questions have to be answered. You have to have funding. You have to have an agency that's going to run it in the end. And I think the state has created the Gulf Coast Protection District here for that to help run this. But again, without funding, and you're looking at around $25 billion to do something of that magnitude. I don't know if I'll see it in my lifetime or not. I just really don't know.
I hope I see it in mine, but I'll be closer to 100 than I'd like to be if it actually happens, because the funding is on an annual basis. You're not going to get an approval for the $30 billion or whatever right up front. And a former Corps of Engineers guy was on the same committee I was on when we were going through some of this stuff, figured it would probably take another big hit to spur a supplemental budgetary process to fund it and get it off dead center, even though we don't really have people. There are people that are opposed to it. There's no question about that. But the fact that we keep building in harm's way and we have so much important industry in harm's way, it would not be very responsible of us if we didn't take care of it. Al,
Yeah, I had a quick question. One of the real take-home points for me today that got me thinking is what Jeff shared about we focus so much on forecasting the height of the storm surge and maybe don't forecast enough on the timing of it. You know, like when I'm forecasting hurricane stuff, I love that the NHC puts out the most likely or the earliest reasonable time arrival of hurricane of tropical storm force winds. That gets people thinking about when they need to be in, like when they need to have everything wrapped up and be on the road. How do we communicate timing of storm surge and say critical thresholds? Like, you know, what are those critical thresholds, and does NHC or do other forecasters, and this is a question for Jeff or Travis or Bill, I mean, how do we, either NHC or just broadcast meteorologists, forecast the timing of storm surge and when people need to be out of harm's way by?
So one of the big, I'll go real quick. One of the big things we use is a software package called HurriVac, and the HurriVac system and software package incorporates the National Hurricane Center advisory package, wind field, and all that information, and then backs out our timeline for when we need to be making decisions and when we need to be finished with those decisions. But it's mainly based on wind speed. I don't think I've seen in HurriVac surge timing. And really, for the most part, the rule of thumb is your 40 mile an hour winds. You start to get your biggest water level rise with the onset of your tropical storm force winds. But we have to be mindful in these big, big storms like Ike, that could be significantly earlier. So 90% of the time, the 40 mile an hour wind rule of thumb works pretty well.
Yeah, the from the Hurricane Center perspective, at least back in those days, and I think even up till now, the ability to forecast the tide run-up that occurs on these big storms, and at least using the slosh model technique, isn't very good. They may have improved on that. I don't know offhand. And models like ADCIRC and whatnot are computationally strenuous. So I don't know if too many people are running that real-time operationally to give us much help on that. They should do better on that sort of thing because of the physics they use.
One tool we do use is the extratropical storm surge forecast. And now this is based off the GFS model, but it will give you that ahead of run up. And so this is another tool we use actually before we have surge guidance. Like, we don't typically get storm surge guidance from the Hurricane Center until closer to landfall, but we can use that extratropical model for coastal tide problems, again, based off the GFS wind field and all that. So you have to take that into consideration.
Good point.
Travis, any insights on how to communicate some of the timing of some of these coastal impacts?
Well, I think you've hit on a really good point that we need as a community to explore this more, because there really aren't great resources right now for timing out the surge. And as Jeff mentioned, this was a rare thing that happened with Ike that really, you know, you go back to the 1900s storm and you read about this. So that's twice in over 100 years you've experienced something like this here on the Upper Texas coastline. And so there's not that many data points and case studies to look at. You know, most of our storms, again, on average, we get about 3 days from the time they form to the time they make landfall. So even as strong as Harvey was, it didn't produce the same kind of massive surge that we saw with Ike, and especially the timing that we saw with Ike. So, you know, my memory is a little fuzzy in terms of what we were saying on the timing of the surge ahead of Ike. But I remember as a meteorologist who had been on TV the day before talking about the storm of the surge, I was shocked when I turned on the TV on Friday morning and saw how high the water already was with the waves topping the Galveston seawall. So I definitely think it's an area where we can improve as a community with the, you know, maybe that's something we talk to the storm surge unit about at NHC and see what kind of headway is being made on that very thing. Because again, that was a life or death moment for a lot of people that got stuck on the Bolivar. And if they did survive, it was the most terrifying experience of their life.
You know, what Jeff said about a lot of times we do these decisions based on the arrival of tropical storm force winds, maybe it's just a good rule of thumb with some of these geographically larger storms to say, hey, you may want to give yourself at least a 6 hour plus buffer on that, or some kind of buffer. It seems like we know it does happen, but it sounds like the science may be some years out for getting more precision with that.
Great point.
Wasn't this early on in the verbiage, you know, when you know, the Hurricane Center started issuing the really strong verbiage, like during Katrina, and in this case, certain death if you stay. And did that motivate people finally? You know, is that something that, you know, if you stay behind, certain death is imminent? Is that something that made a difference? And because, again, that was relatively early on when that verbiage started being used.
You know, I've talked to a lot of people, and I'm kind of getting off Ike a little bit. I talked to a lot of people doing a lot of surveys with Laura and Ida and Ian and Michael. And we can go this at another time and really talk about why people do what they do. But the what is being said tends to not influence their decisions a whole lot. You know, the language, they make decisions so much based on historical context. Like, I've lived here for 40 years. I lived on Bolivar for 40 years. I was perfectly fine with Hurricane Alicia. I was perfectly fine with Hurricane Carla. Look at Rita. I was perfectly fine. I'll be fine again. And we see this and we hear this time and time and time again. The only place I did not hear that was in Southwest Louisiana with Laura. And I don't know if it's because Rita and Ike were very fresh for them and they have a very nasty storm surge history there, but the evacuation compliance in Southwest Louisiana for Laura was very, very high. But getting people to do what you're asking them to do and all of that, really goes beyond, I think, what we can do. I mean, we say what we say, we show what we show. You know, I think there's probably some better things that can be done with respect to how we sow storm surge, and the Hurricane Center is doing some really great stuff. But is that getting to the person sitting in their office or sitting at their house? Or, you know, we're immersed in it. We see it all the time. It's like, how are you not understanding this? How are you not getting this? But the other thing you have to think about is a decision process with a person. When you say you got to leave, they don't just get in their car and leave. This is a process. This is an 8-hour process. You know, kids are at school, people are at work, they come home. Well, I'm not going to leave today. I'm not leaving in the middle of the night. I want to get up and go tomorrow morning. And so during all this time, they're being bombarded with information. And you know, one of the biggest challenges we face right now is a consistent message from multiple sources. And if you get that, people will generally heed that message. But with all the stuff out there on social media, and we have really seen a significant uptick this year in really bad information being put out and people listening to that and confusing the official messages that are coming out of what you should be doing. And I honestly don't know how we deal with this going forward, because it's getting to the point where it's rising to the occasion where people are just not really getting that official stuff anymore. They're getting really garbage messaging from a lot of places.
Yeah.
And Travis, jump on that too.
Yeah. I thought about the big changes in how you actually do business, how much you have streaming and other social media aspects. How do you see that playing out? Cause I think it's still been shown in surveys that, when you have a big threat like that, most people turn to their favorite news media source to get information. So how do you see that fitting in with the social media and streaming aspects?
I think the latest research shows that local TV news is still the number one source people turn to, especially when it's, you know, extreme weather events. And social media is actually only about 10% people turning that to that source first to get their information. But there are generational differences in where people are consuming their information. So you'll have these things go viral on TikTok about Category 6 hurricanes going into Florida and the East Coast that never turn into reality. And it does a lot of damage both ways, with one, with getting people freaked out, and two, being like, well, I can't trust anything I see anymore. So there is a, you know, the way people are consuming media is a challenge because things have become so fragmented, which is why we do things like the integrated weather team workshops the integrated warning team workshops, to be able to work with the different partners that are responsible for getting the message out, from the public communicators to the emergency managers, National Weather Service, because we have to have as unified of a message as possible and hope that that's enough to get the message across. The thing that concerns me here locally in Southeast Texas is we have a large transient population. So we have a lot of people that come in, like we have a huge influx of people coming from California where they don't really experience the kinds of weather we experience. We did a study between Ike and Harvey. We had 1 million new people move here between Ike and Harvey. I mean, that have no context of the past. It's also a large international community that comes here. And so people don't have the same context and weather experiences that we get. And so there's a lot of people that just don't know what to do. And so the first thing that they do is they go out of their apartment, their house, their neighborhood. They look around and what are my neighbors doing? And there's kind of that group think that takes over. Well, if they're not leaving, then I'm not going to leave. And so that's one of the bigger motivating factors or determining factors of whether someone stays or goes is what they see the people around them doing, which was why Rita became such a fiasco, because everyone tried to get on the road and it was terrible. The other thing is, like, I don't think we brought this up today, but we talk about it a lot. We're always going up against the last storm. And so I remember in the context of Rita had just happened, disastrous evacuation. More people died in the evacuation than the actual hurricane here in Texas. It was that bad. So all these people said, I'm not leaving. I'm staying put. They could tell me to leave during Ike. I'm not doing it because it wasn't worth it. And then every single person that I talked to after Ike said, I am never staying for a hurricane again. That was the worst night of my life, you know? And that was just, you know, category one gust across Houston. And then the last big storm we've had now is Harvey. And so people that are new to the area think a hurricane is just a huge flood with very minimal wind impacts. And so, you know, those that are really clued in and tuned in, you know, are more discerning than that. But for a large part of the population, they're not as clued in as we'd like to think they are when it comes to these storms and what they do. And so it's a real challenge, but it's an important reason why we do things like what we're doing today, where we take a look back at what these storms have done. We have to tell these stories because they are honestly infrequent events, but when they happen, they're life-altering, life-changing events, things that will stick with you for the rest of your life. And there's always lessons that we learn. In fact, one thing I'm excited about is we're doing a new streaming newscast that's all about the weather. We're doing one at noon today, and we're dedicating the whole thing to the lessons learned from Ike and taking a look back. And so you can watch that on our stream later if you've got more time to stream later on during the day. So it's important that we tell these stories and that we try to keep a unified message when these things are hitting, because we are going up against a lot of misinformation. And it wouldn't surprise me one bit if there's actually a bit of disinformation going on. You know, I wouldn't put under beyond any of our foreign adversaries during times of crisis to try to get in conflicting messages to confuse the American public. That's just my two cents.
Travis, you mentioned that local TV news is still number one. Social media, maybe growing, it's at 10%. If a high impact event came, I mean, how would you, I would imagine you're messaging on both of those, right?
We're messaging on all platforms. It doesn't matter where they consume it in our mind. You know, when it comes to life-saving information, we're going to put it out on every single platform we can. So we've got our linear TV signal. We've got our streaming channel, our own apps, and, you know, hitting the mobile devices. And we're going to broadcast things on social media with all the different live tools that are available there as well, in hopes that we're hitting as many people as possible during those extreme events.
Yeah.
Coming up on the top of the hour, we promised you guys we'd get you out of here in an hour. So let's wrap this up and you know, we talk often, and you guys have both touched on how history is a lousy teacher when it comes to hurricane, because no two storms are alike. But let me start, Travis, with you. What is the one thing we can glean out of Ike that we can use today? You know, if we know now what we know now, kind of thing. And I'll ask you afterwards, Jeff, the same question. So Travis, what do you think? What's the one thing from Ike that we can glean? The
main thing is to focus on the different hazards. The four big ones from a hurricane are going to be your storm surge, your inland flooding, the winds from the storm, and the tornadoes. Each storm is going to have a unique representation and manifestation of those four different hazards. And we have to key in on what's the most impactful and life-threatening one. And it's on, there is a bit of individual responsibility for people to know their own risk. I believe it's estimated that here in Houston, half the population moves within the city every 2 to 2.5 years because of, you know, people transitioning between different apartment communities. So you may have experienced Harvey in this part of town, but you live in a different part of town now. And so you have to always know your own risk and be looking at those specific hazards, not just a category number of a storm.
Good stuff. Jeff, same question. And you can follow up on what he talked about. I told you before the show, my daughter moved a mile in that Bridgeland area, which from one flood zone to another, probably, you know, but what's the one thing you gleaned from the experience with Ike?
You know, I agree with Travis 100%. It's your risk and educating yourself on the risk you face. You know, are you in an evacuation area that you could be affected by storm surge, you know, having that plan in place, and then, you know, understanding the risk you face inland from wind and freshwater flooding is, you know, this is what we preach all the time. This is what all of us do 365 days out of the year, and especially from June to October here, is this is what we do. And, you know, most people aren't even going to think about this or look at it until there's something in the Gulf. And, you know, we keep saying, do it, look at it. And there's one last piece of advice. I think this was Bill maybe who said this one time, is the price we pay for living here is you have are you willing to evacuate and have absolutely nothing happen? And just let that sink in, because it's the truth. You know, you have to be willing to go, and you can't get mad that you sat in traffic and you came back and your house was perfectly fine and go down that road. That's the price we have for living here on the Gulf Coast is you got to go and come back and everything's fine, because that one time you don't, things may not be fine and you may not be around to have that option to do it again. And so, you know.
In 1984, I interviewed Neil Frank, and we talked about evacuations and nothing happening. And I've never forgotten his quote. He says, "Overwarning is the price you have to pay for the great way of life we have on our coastline today." And you can hear, you know, Neil saying that, and it's so true. And it's still the case today, even though warnings and, you know, cones have gotten smaller, warnings have gotten tighter. It's still the case. So, Hal, what do we learn today?
You know, really, like they say, there's more to the story than the category, right? Like these other guys are saying, it's looking at all your hazards, especially like a life-threatening storm surge that may not align well with a higher category storm, but it still may be deadly.
Appreciate it, Hal. Bill?
One last point I want to make, I think, is I actually think, yes, we want to make improvements in the science of the forecasting and warnings of this stuff, but I think we've gotten good enough now that we really have to look at the other part of the problem, which Jeff alluded to, is the people part of the problem. How do we change how they respond? Because the forecasts and warnings are good enough that if people acted on them, they'd save their lives. So I've always thought that you need to, the ultimate goal would be what, either this kind of device or whatever replaces it down the road. Somewhere down the road, we're going to get good enough with the computational skills to where we can personalize the threat. A person can punch in their location and find out what their risks are and do that. And I think that's the kind of goals we should be working towards.
Perfect program today, guys. Great messages. And you know your risk, most importantly, and understand that risk, because everybody is different. Every person is unique and different. And all four of you guys are right there in the Ike zone. So thanks for taking time to be with us today and expressing those concerns and those interests. So, gentlemen, thank you. Great program today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Tim.
All right, good job, guys. I want to thank our sponsors who are part of this program each and every week, USAA, the South Padre Island Convention and Visitors Bureau, the Weather Company, and Weather Boy, all the folks who make these programs a possibility each and every week. Thanks, gentlemen, for being with us today. Thank you all for watching today and listening on the podcast. We'll see you next time for NTWC Live. Take care.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of NTWC Live Hurricane Center Podcast. If you did, head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review. And join us next week. This is NTWC Live.